Michael Townsend wasn't happy when his city, Providence, Rhode Island, decided to build a big mall downtown. He was afraid the mall would destroy the old city. Well, the mall does bring people downtown. It has 170 stores and 8 restaurants and an IMAX theater, but for 3 years it also had an illegal apartment deep in its cinder block innards. That was Michael, living at the mall.
If you climbed up the metal ladder, you would get to a cinder block wall that we had built with a metal door that we had a key to, and you would open up the door we had installed, and if you had a jacket, you could put it on the coat hangers to the right, and if you had some belongings, you could toss them casually onto the white 2-seater love seat.
Michael's life at the mall began as part of a game. He had no idea how permanent his place at the mall would become. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
When Providence Place Mall was opened 9 years ago, it was meant to be the new center of the city, promoted as the ideal venue for tour de force shopping, excursions, family outings, and intimate rendezvous. It is, they say, the centerpiece of a downtown Providence renaissance. Some people who watched it go up weren't so sure. Michael Townsend is an artist in Providence. He and his friends spent the first years opposing the mall and fighting to preserve the old red brick industrial neighborhoods around that site. But then, as an experiment, they thought, okay, rather than attack the mall, why not get to know it, embrace it? So four of them devised a game. Andrew, Adriana, Jay, and Michael would each vote in or choose one article of survival gear that each one would carry. And then they'd try to live at the mall for a week. I'll let Michael explain the rules.
Everyone voted in an object. I voted in a flashlight. And so all four of us got flashlights. And Adriana voted in an emergency car blanket, those little tinfoil numbers that keep in the glove compartment. So everyone had that because we weren't sure where we were going to sleep, and it was October. We just wanted to make it brutal for ourselves. Jay voted in a sketchbook, and so one of our first priorities when we got there was to find a pen. Okay. And then Andrew voted in a face cloth. I've never really forgiven him for that. So everyone had a face cloth. And
Perfect.
Then we each got $20 a piece for the week. And we didn't bring cell phones, but we were allowed to use phones to call in food, which means that if a friend wanted to bring us food, they could come to the mall and meet us with a bounty of things to eat.
But you'd have to use a payphone at the mall to call them in, right?
Yes.
Okay. So does this mean that you were going to try and spend a week at the mall undetected?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And obviously the big question is, where in the world do you sleep at night? And that was our first priority the first day. So we walked there on a Friday morning, and it was one of the most suspenseful walks I've ever taken in my life. Because there's that, we weren't sure whether we were actually going to be able to spend a week there. You know, maybe we'd be there for 5 hours and they would say, hey, you guys, stop walking around and kick us out. What it did is it led us to explore the mall in a way that we had never explored it before.
Just because you had to? Because you had to kill all that time, right?
It was a necessity. We had the time. We had cleared the calendars. I didn't have a cell phone. I wasn't checking my mail.
Did you do this together or did you break up, split up?
It was a combination of things. We would meet at regular intervals at pre-designated places. And part of that was to make sure that none of us had been kicked out.
Did you have code or something?
Well, we had specific places that we meet in the food court,
right?
Places that were just sort of a little bit less traveled.
I have to ask you, Michael, what the mall security people would have seen you and your friends. Do you have any unusual distinguishing marks, like tattoos or purple hair or strange clothing, that would attract a guard? I mean, did you have reason to believe that you wouldn't somehow fit into the mall crowd and you might be targeted?
Our first step to try to fit in more was I went to Nordstrom's and I got a shopping bag.
Very smart.
I just went and asked for it. It's like, can I have a large Nordstrom shopping bag? And really that bag, that single bag, was our camouflage for the entire time we were there. So regardless of what we were wearing, as long as we could show that we had purchased something or were intending to purchase something, that seemed to be enough evidence that we had
legitimate reason to be there. Yeah. I want to know, though, what was closing time at the mall?
There is a very large movie theater there, and so it will be open till 2, 3 in the morning.
Right.
there is this moment between when the stores close and the movie theater close that the mall is essentially empty, but you can freely move around it.
But just the public space, right? I mean, all those chrome and glass shutters are pulled down over the entrances to the stores, right? Place me there. You come, maybe you see a movie, maybe you don't, maybe you just sort of figure at midnight or at 2 a.m., you're going to look very suspicious to the security guard who's watching the cameras or however that's going to work. What do you do then?
Well, actually, by that time, we're in bed already.
Oh, okay. Where's bed?
It ended up being two different spaces. Jay and Andrew came back and reported that they had found in the parking garage a column that had an entrance in it, and the entrance was about 6 feet from the ground, and they could climb into this 4-foot by 4-foot column. It was just, you know, it was like a raccoon living in a chimney, basically.
But there was enough room for the two of them to lie down in there?
There was enough room for the two of them to sort of create different spaces for themselves to be in. I mean, it sounds awfully tight, but they made life easier for themselves the following day by spending part of their $20 at Filene's to buy the cheapest sheets they could, and they made hammocks.
Michael had a different idea. Remember, he'd been watching this mall when it was being built, and he'd noticed an interior space being used for the storage of construction stuff. He thought it might never have become part of the finished mall, so he set out to find it.
I was in the garage and then walking around the perimeter of the mall and discovered something else that I had noticed when they were building the mall but had never investigated, and that was two walls, cinder blocks, that had been built right next to each other. So they put up this large concrete wall, and then about 11 inches away, they put up another one. And I was able to traverse this I-beam between these two walls.
Wait a second. I'm getting a little bit lost. I was with you as we were squeezing between two cinder block walls.
Okay.
But what are we walking on at that point? Are we walking on like the same surface that's in the parking garage, or what?
What ends up happening is it's concrete, but then it turns into an I-beam. So these walls are built on either side of an I-beam.
Okay, do I have to step up on this, or is it floor level?
You are walking straight at that point.
Uh-huh.
But then off to the left is a pit, and that pit falls a story and a half into another storage space.
You would only know this because you had a flashlight, right?
Yes. If I didn't have a flashlight, I would have fallen into a pit.
Okay, so are you walking on the I-beam now? Is it a balancing act?
It's a balancing act to one side.
Okay.
So there is a wall that I'm able to sort of skirt along.
How wide is the beam, Michael?
The beam is approximately 8 to 9 inches.
Ooh, okay.
So it's a thin trail.
You need to have your wits about you as you do this.
You need to be sure-footed, yes.
Yeah, okay.
Luckily, I've practiced the I-beam walk before, so I'm gripped with confidence that I'll be okay.
How long is this walk along the beam?
This walk is about, 30, 40 feet. The further it went, the more I actually was beginning to lose track. Even though I had a mental map of sort of where I was,
yeah,
I was completely lost. I was like, am I in the parking garage? Am I nearing a store? But then I saw a cross I-beam, an angled I-beam. So you're able to go up this 45-degree angle up a story inside of this squeeze space.
See, now I'm starting to get edgy. I was going to walk with you this far because it was on a level, but now with a pit on one side and a narrow little I-beam going up at 45 degrees, I'm thinking to myself, you know what? I'm not sure I want to follow you.
Yeah, I may have been able to, if we were there together, I could have talked you through the first part, but I will admit that the angle would have involved some coaxing.
Okay, all right.
So I've grabbed your hand, and I'm pulling you up this 45-degree angle I-beam, and this enters into the very space that I had seen 4 years ago. And all of a sudden, you're in a room. The walls are all cinder blocks. And everything is cinder block.
What's the floor?
The floor is solid concrete.
And what's above you?
And above us is, it's a metal ceiling with a fireproofing material on it that looks like a combination of sawdust and vomit. So it is, as you can imagine, quite grim.
So what happened on that first night? Did you spend a night there?
Oh, yeah. Adriana, the column was nice for my two companions there. But Adriana, I just talked to Adriana. I was like, well, you could sleep there, or I've got this pretty sweet, huge space that we could go to. And so we made a bed out of insulation tiles, and then we used the emergency blankets that Adriana had voted in, and we settled into a pretty uncomfortable night of sleeping.
Was it cold?
It was cold. Man, was it cold. Cold, and the other side product was crinkly. Those little blankets, so they're warm. Anytime you make any movement whatsoever, they crinkle.
Yeah.
And so we're in a space that was dead silent outside of the occasional thumping and bumping of cars, and then just this constant crinkle all night. So it wasn't the best night's sleep, but it was very, for lack of a better word, safe. That genuine sense that no one would ever find you there.
Michael and his friends got to thinking. They could come back to this safe place anytime they wanted. And then Michael heard something on the radio that gave him an even better idea.
The radio started playing an ad for the mall with this enthusiastic female voice saying, quite literally, quotes, "Wouldn't it be great to move into the Providence Place Mall?" And she continued to tell her story, that she wanted to move into the mall, and that if she were able to do this, she would have the best that life has to offer, the greatest shopping, food and entertainment and friends. Her tone was pure joy. And hearing this woman, hearing this ad, I was like, you know, right on. I'm with you.
You were the only person listening to this ad who actually had discovered a space and had a plan or an idea of a way to actually live in the mall, right?
I felt every word that she said. I really,
it's like the voice,
could not have agreed with her more.
The voice of God.
I wanted to meet the actor who did it. I was like, if I could just meet her and let her know that her work is not in vain, that she really, really spoke to someone that day. At that point, I was like, you know, this isn't just about Micah developing a space. This is about, for me personally, about chasing that feeling.
It was the beginning of an adventure for Michael Townsend and his friends. How would they turn that dark, dusty storage space into their place at Providence Place? We'll find out in a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. For close to 4 years, Michael Townsend and a small group of friends had something, well, many people dream of. They had an almost livable apartment inside a major shopping mall. No one knew about it but them. Michael had discovered this space somewhere between the parking garage and the downtown Providence Place Mall in Rhode Island. What they had was a floor and walls, a ceiling, and a secret entryway up a ladder. Not much else.
Oh, so dirty. It was just filled with dust and concrete shards and discarded cabling and wood scraps. You know, there were newspapers from 98, 99.
But you knew about this filthy, trash-littered, former piece of a construction dump site space that was in the bowels of the mall.
Yes.
It must have taken a fair amount of imagination to figure out a way of getting all that junk out to make it more habitable, and then to put stuff in to make it actually a fun or comfortable place to be.
Well, that was the very first step that took up a bit of time, which was just cleaning it out in preparation for the arrival of furniture.
How long did it take to clean it out, Michael?
It took a while. The beginning of 2004 was dedicated to cleaning. Because cleaning is obviously a multi-tiered event. You've got a lot of just the brushing and bagging of loose debris and dust. And
wait a second. You can't walk around the mall with a green bag full of dust and pieces of concrete. How did you get the stuff out? Why weren't you caught or noticed?
Well, the cleaning process you could actually do entirely by moving through our private entranceway. And you could move materials out of that space with a backpack. So
this is like the scene from The Great Escape where the prisoners are digging a tunnel and they're walking around the ground shaking the dirt out of their pants.
very, very similar in a very strange way, yes. It's almost it's the same process, but on a slightly larger scale and for different reasons.
Now, there were no lights. What did you do for light?
Well, during the initial stages, we just used battery-operated lights. So we used camping flashlights, you know, ones that would cast a significant enough glow.
Yeah. Okay, but there's still no electricity in this place, right?
At that point, there wasn't, because we hadn't been smart enough to venture down to the storage space below us and realize, wait a second, there's a plug here. Once we made that discovery, a 70-foot extension cord later, we were able to have work lamps in full effect.
And all the time that you're cleaning it out and imagining how you're going to decorate it, is there any running water here?
There's no running water. That was one of the constant, you know, Achilles' heel of this entire endeavor.
So no toilet either, right?
No toilet. And we're 3 months away from installing our toilet.
I won't ask.
This whole conversation is actually really frustrating because we were caught.
You had this plan.
Yeah. We had the plan. We had done all the research. I knew how to plumb out. We had bought the wood floors. We were going to install it 3 days after I had been busted.
But what were you doing early on? What did you do when you had to go to the bathroom?
The bathroom was just a matter of taking a short trip to the mall. The mall's right there. It's open almost all the time. And, you know, it's quite pleasant. So bathroom and eating were, during the construction period, just a short trip away.
So you go to the food court, have something to eat, use the bathroom, and go back into the space, right?
You got it.
So before you were busted, before you lost this space,
yes,
what did it look like? Take me on a visual tour of what you had done with this strange interior mall space, this mystery space.
Well, we'd given it our best shot to make it a comfortable, cozy living space. So,
did you have furniture in there?
Yes. If you climbed up the metal ladder, you would get to a cinder block wall that we had built with a metal door that we had a key to, and you would open up the door we had installed. And if you had a jacket, you could put it on the coat hangers to the right. And if you had some belongings, you could toss them casually onto the white two-seater love seat off to the left. Flush on the left
wall. Wait
a
second. You had upholstered furniture in this place?
Yeah, very nice piece, actually. That one. That was an antique.
I'm sorry. I don't understand how you get this stuff in. I have never seen, you know, two people carrying a used piece of furniture through a mall who wouldn't in some way attract the attention of even the thickest person in charge of security. How did you do this?
Something that should be said aloud at this point is that we made every attempt during this entire process to make sure that security was never embarrassed. So for smaller objects, if you have a lamp, even if you're walking through the mall with a lamp, there's a certain set of assumptions that the objects that you have, since they are decorating objects,
sure,
furniture objects, are from the mall itself.
I bought this. It doesn't work. I'm taking it back.
Or I'm going to my car.
There must have been something you carried in, though. I'm thinking about the upholstered two-seater love seat. But, I mean, there must have been something that you carried in there where you paused outside the mall and said, okay, this is going to be a real test. See if we can get this in.
I think the piece of furniture that qualifies for that would be the China hutch. So there was this 7-foot-high, very wide wood and glass, you know, victory piece of furniture that stored all of our china and glasses and silverware and various pots and pans and cooking utensils, that when you walked into our space, you would look straight across the living room and the dining area, and there was the china hutch staring back at you.
How many people does it take to lift the china hutch?
It takes three people to move it with confidence, but two people who are gripped with adrenaline can move it pretty easily, actually.
I guess you had a combination of both, right?
It's surprising what you can carry, really.
But wait a second. You had to get this big, ungainly piece of furniture up a ladder through a door?
Yes. It was challenging.
So back to the list. There's this big hutch. There's a love seat. What else have we got in there?
Let's see. If you throw your backpack onto the love seat, to the right of that, flush against the cinder block wall, is a four-piece sectional couch. and it's facing a low wood coffee table. Centered on that is a small television set with a PlayStation, some controllers, some movies and games. Across from the couch, to the right, are two chests of drawers for our clothing.
Why not?
And you know, the chests of drawers are decorated with lamps and shadow boxes. And in the dining area, there was a glass table and was seating for four.
I have a picture of the place in my mind now, but what I'm not still quite clear on, Michael, is were you setting up a kind of showcase apartment to prove that it could be done, or did you live in this place?
We lived in it.
How many nights? I mean, you found it in 2003. You cleaned it in 2004 and decorated it in, what, in 04 and 05, I guess,
yep,
right?
Yep. Yeah.
How many nights would you have slept there?
Oh, I don't really have a sense of the volume.
I mean, 100, 10?
Oh, yeah, no, more pushing a three-digit number. The length of stays are the things that were more interesting to me. There would be periods of time where I'd stay for several weeks in a row. And the thing that would drive me from the space every time was a dissatisfaction with the objects that I had around me.
You needed more stuff.
I needed more stuff.
And you were living in a mall.
And there you have it, my friend. The mall drove me to distraction. The two chests of drawers, the mismatched chests of drawers, were so alarming to me after several weeks of looking at them. And then you'd go into the mall and you would see the template for how things could be.
What it could be.
And Adriana and I are married.
Now, wait a second. This is key here, because you and Adriana got married while you were making this place, right?
Yes.
Did this
yes.
become a kind of nesting exercise for the two of you? I mean, be honest with me.
Oh, absolutely. It was the place where things that we would never, ever do in our own home could happen. And during the course of time, and the thing is, there are things that we also kind of want to happen, especially Adriana. And the mall became a place where we could focus those sort of decorative or domestic urges and anxieties. During the time we were developing it, we were subscribing to Martha Stewart Living Magazine and Domino and Blueprint, fantastic. And
Blueprint, yes. Martha Stewart, yeah. I don't know. It may be not your thing, but
Well, surprisingly, there were a lot of things in there that we thought we might have been able to implement.
How far is your tongue in your cheek as you're telling me this, though? I mean,
you know, the problem is, see, and there's your problem, is it's not that far. We were, especially Adriana, was starting to scrapbook ideas, and we were cross-referencing these different types of interior decorating magazines. We were fascinated in the impulses that you can have for decorating that don't necessarily fit in our day-to-day life, but in the mall maybe seemed like a good idea. So Adriana was, you know, like that little shelf that has little glass vials that have sand from every single beach you've ever walked, nicely labeled with a thick Sharpie on a white shelf with a floral decorative mounting. Very good. Cloth runners across dining room tables. That was a constant joke that she wanted to have that happen in her own house. I was like, no. That's what the mall is for.
What did you call it? What did you call this space?
We would just refer to it as the mall.
You'd say, where do you want to sleep tonight, Adriana? You want to sleep here? You want to sleep in the mall?
Okay. Yeah, it's like, well, so where were you? It's like, oh, I was at the mall. So whenever you referred to the mall, it was pretty clear that you were talking about this other home that you lived in.
And how close did you come to letting your other place go, to just stop paying rent and say, you know what, it's time we made a commitment to the mall, that we really started to stay at the mall?
There's nothing more. I would have loved to have reached a point where that space was comfortable enough that we would be able to give up our other home.
Were you close?
We were not close. There are a lot of things that need to happen in order for that to happen.
Like a toilet, like windows, like things that.
I think we'd have to win the legal suit. We'd have to win our squatting rights suit. And at this point, I should say, it isn't our space. It's private property. We were trespassing. We were breaking the law the entire time we were there. This is something we weren't consciously thinking.
I know, but it didn't stop you from sleeping there. Let's face it.
No, no, it didn't.
And you'd still decorating. Be there now if you hadn't been busted, right?
That's very true. If we hadn't been busted, it would have a wood veneer floor right now, the entire space. We would have repainted the walls at this point, and we would be building custom cabinets for the kitchen. That was the plan by the end of October.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Michael Townsend lived inside his place, inside the Providence Place Mall, on and off for about 4 years. The experiment ended late last fall. Michael says he and his wife, Adriana, were the authors of their own undoing.
We busted ourselves. We made some mistakes. We had two golden rules, and we broke both of them. The rules were never bring anybody there who wasn't directly involved in making it.
One.
And the number two rule was don't ever, ever put any information about this project on the web. No photographs, no images, no video. Don't even talk about it.
So there's a video, and it's on the web, or it went on the web?
Yeah. Here's how I understand it. Adriana and I, she had a colleague who was studying malls also and studying the impact of malls in cities and the relationship that malls have to housing projects and whatnot. And we said, hey, you know, we've got some video of us living at a mall that you might be interested in seeing just because it gives you additional context for what you're studying. And we put together a little two-minute snippet of documentation we had and posted it, gave it a little title, but no description. It was completely out of context. Last summer, here in Providence, we were asked to give a talk about the mall. Not about living there, but about other things we'd been researching and studying, especially Adriana's work. And after our presentation, one of the audience members, who apparently loved the presentation, full of enthusiasm, he set off to his computer and wrote a wonderful and eloquent description of everything that he had experienced and knew about his trip to Providence. Included in that was a link to an old site of Adriana's that happened to have a link, if you searched hard enough, for this video. Adriana and I had abandoned that website and moved on to a new one.
Right.
And his description apparently was so well written that if you did a certain Google search for the name of the mall and the mall's owner, it would come up as the number two. So, as the number two Google search,
but somebody would have had to be looking, right? So far, you're okay because right now, none of the mall owners have any reason to be hunting you down.
Not that we know of. However, there is one other thing that happened, which was that in the springtime, our door was broken down, and
this was the door to the mall, the one you used.
This is the door to our apartment.
So someone had come through the original door, come up the ladder, and broken into the apartment. Okay.
And broke into our apartment and, you know, knocked the door off its hinges with their mighty boot and stole our PlayStation and our games and our shadow box. So we had a burglary in our own space. And
you had a leak.
And we had a leak. So somebody knew we went through different layers of paranoia, and we sort of came to the conclusion that it has to be a petty burglary because they haven't returned to take other things that are valuable. I will find out when I am captured by security that one of the security guards had actually been the one who had kicked the door in. Whether they took our belongings, who knows? But that does indicate that they were aware that there was an apartment in their mall, and then with the additional video evidence of me standing in the mall in that space, they had more than enough clues to realize they should be keeping their eyes wide open at that very specific location.
So Michael Townsend and his wife, Adriana Yotto, had broken the first rule. They had allowed images of their house, or their apartment, to find their way onto the web. And then Michael broke the second rule. He brought in an outsider. I'll ask him about that in just a minute. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Michael Townsend and his wife, Adriana Yoto, and a handful of friends kept a secret apartment inside the Providence Place Mall in Rhode Island for almost 4 years. Because the apartment was illegal, they had strict rules about secrecy. Well, two rules. Don't post on the internet, and don't bring in any outsiders. Well, the internet rule had been breached, but they thought they were still okay. Then Michael found himself hosting a visiting artist from Hong Kong. He was supposed to take her back to the airport, but he made a detour to the mall.
I thought, what harm could it possibly be? She's going to go back to Hong Kong, tell her Hong Kong friends, they'll talk about it in Chinese, write about it in Chinese. What possible harm could come of showing a complete and total stranger this space? And I thought to myself, you know, if the door's open, we'll go in. If it's not, we won't go in. And we went through some back hallways. We got to that door. Sure enough, it's ajar. I'm like, great, there's a sign. Went in, showed her the apartment. She was fascinated and confused. We came back down the ladder into the abandoned storage space. I reach for the door, and I hear a walkie-talkie on the other side of the door. And I realized at that moment, it would appear the gig is up.
You could have stayed inside.
I could have run. I could have...
Oh, yeah, because you could have gone back up and inside and all the way down the I-beams and out the back exit. And
you
nobody
got it.
Would have, yeah, and?
Super, super easy escape. No question about it. Even if they were in the room, I could have escaped. However, part of my wiring, and you know, I guess I blame my mom and dad for this, is this intense sense of sportsmanship. And the sportsmanship in this case is, okay, they've done it. They have found me. And I just felt like there's no point in running here. They need to be rewarded. They did it. The clues were put together. They found me. And it is their right, genuinely their right, to bust me at that point.
Wait a minute. This is like the fox who turns around to the hounds and say, you got me. Take me home. You know,
a little bit.
Was there a part of you that wanted the game to end? That wanted the sort of subterfuge to come to an end?
I've searched myself for that answer, and I think the answer is no.
Yeah.
And that's because it pains me to not have developed that space further. Like, it really does. It's a big loss in my life, because it was such an important part of how I went about my daily business and what possibilities existed for, and also for me, you know, I'm 36 years old, and my regular appearance, I work for myself, so I don't have to prescribe to any sort of dress code necessarily. And within the mall, and living there, I felt that there was going to be this natural evolution where I would just become a little bit cleaner, a little bit sharper, a little bit better dressed, a little bit more presentable, a little bit more professional, you know, a little bit more like the posters that stared back at me every time I went into the mall.
You wanted to be a mannequin.
I wanted to participate. There was this desire to actually try to just, I don't know how to say it, like evolve, for lack of a better word.
What happened at the moment of the arrest, though? You heard the walkie-talkie.
I heard the walkie-talkie, and I stepped back behind the door, and the door opened. So now I'm standing behind the door, and I did have that silent prayer of, oh, please let them just look in the space, see nobody there, and then walk away. And they turned on the light, and they closed the door, And in closing the door, that's me standing 2 feet away from them. And I just said, surprise! And they were shocked, not amused. But for me, it was such a horrible moment because I was standing there in t-shirts and graying shorts with sneakers with holes in them, mismatched socks, and there I was being busted by the mall. Three guys in nice dress shirts with like casual but pressed pants and modest but fairly expensive belts and dress shoes.
These weren't the security guards that we normally see then. This was a level up from that.
Level up from that. And they were sort of what I was growing towards. You know, in best case scenario, in the moment of busting me, I would have been a reflection of themselves. They would have been looking into a mirror. We would have given each other high fives, and they would have said, good job, man. And you know, I would have walked on, but that's not what happened. I was busted and for the very thing that I was trying to evolve away from.
Michael Townsend and the artist from Hong Kong were both questioned, and it soon became clear that the Chinese artist was innocent. Michael confessed to the mall security staff, telling them all about the secret passages into his apartment. But his ordeal wasn't over.
The police came and got me in handcuffs, and six handcuffs sets later, I was brought before a judge the following morning after spending a night at the police station. And the judge, when read the charges against me, decided that this was a misdemeanor trespassing charge.
Did the judge smile at all? Or did you have a finger wave in your face?
But it wasn't really a smiling kind of judge. A lot of other people smiled. The courtroom, all my fellow inmates at the time. You know, it was a little bit more confusing than humorous. But since then, it's been nothing but smiles.
Since then, Michael, you, I understand, have been approached by newspapers in Pakistan, by shock jock radio programs, by people all over the country, people around the world who want to know about this moment, this act of somehow living in the mall. Do you think it's because we all imagine doing what you do, occupying a space that doesn't belong to us? Or do you think it has something to do with our growing attachment to malls and our you know, going back to that ad, you know, would you like to live at the mall? Do you think there's truth in that?
I think there absolutely is. This Providence Place Mall here is a regional super mall. And that format is sort of on its way out, from what I understand. And what that means is that instead of creating these massive, singular, centralized shopping complexes, they're looking more towards the idea of lifestyle centers. And you see these springing up all over the country. And what that means is that the shopping is accompanied by housing.
So we are going to live at the mall.
We are. We already are. There's so many examples across the country of...
I mean, I know about the Saturdays spent at the mall and you know, the going to the mall after school because it's the most interesting place to go. And I know about the condos going up around the mall. But I have to tell you, right, there's a part of me that just finds that horrible. The idea that we are just so drawn to this place for the activity of browsing and shopping. And I mean, you're someone who actually lived in the mall, who had this all around them. What's your perspective on it?
I think you're right in a sense that there is something to worry about, because I've been in towns where the town hall is what would appear to be a normal town hall, but all the buildings around it is a one to two-story shopping complex with all the major international players. And then the center of town is faux skating rinks. You know, they'll have carolers during the Christmas season. So these are the first steps towards mall towns, I guess. You know, our moving into the mall, I think the reason the story seems to captivate people is because we culturally are moving in that direction at a pretty, pretty steady rate. And there's proof that that's an okay model. We just happened to cut out the middleman when we did our project.
And so you have this little moment when you can, you know, in radio interviews like this one and all the others, say, it's a good thing. We should all live at the mall or not.
Well, there's the thing. Is I think one of the major themes in the emails that I've received, I've received a couple hundred emails, not a single one of them has been negative. They're saying thank you, which always surprises me, but they say thank you a lot.
But surely some of that thank you is thank you for sticking it to the man. Thank you for occupying that space.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
No question about it. But I think that's where this project seems to land squarely in everybody's mind, which is right between sticking it to the mall and, gee, I'd really like to go shopping and get the best prices.
It's the ambivalence,
and,
right? You know, we hate it and we love it.
We love it so much. And this little enterprise that we set out on, though it wasn't the intention by any stretch of the imagination, yeah, seems to capture that dilemma perfectly. Just perfectly.
Michael Townsend talked with me from the studios of WRNI just across the way from Providence Place Mall in Providence, Rhode Island. Now that his secret is out, we can show you pictures of the apartment in the mall, and you can find those at thestory.org. If you're a regular listener to the show, you know that we often end our programs with something we call your story. You know, those surprising coincidences, powerful turning points, stories that still make you laugh. Tom Sivak wrote me a note about a story of his that links his redheaded grandmother to a traumatic art class, a strange call from Iowa, and a woodpecker with a pink halo. Bear with me. Tom's story starts in a basement art class run by a woman in his neighborhood.
I would say there were about 10 to 15 kids in this basement, and I was 6 years old, and I recall that I was by far the youngest in the class, so I didn't have any comrades, you know.
They didn't treat you that well?
Well, no, and I don't know that I brought it on myself or if they were just mean, but, you know, I recall being dragged over to the wash basin, and they put my head into the faucet and poured kitchen cleanser in my hair, and, you know, I had a crew cut and kind of gave me a... You know, what do you call those? With your knuckles?
What's that called? Noogies or what?
Yeah, like a noogie with kitchen cleanser in my hair.
Nice.
You know? And I'm crying and screaming, and you know, where the teacher is when this is going on, I couldn't tell you that either.
But one memorable piece of art came from this class. Tell me about your woodpecker painting.
Well, it was kind of dedicated to my grandmother. My grandmother had red hair, and my grandmother was very young. I remember her 50th birthday. In fact, in 1958, she was 50 years old, so that was kind of a 50th birthday present for her, this woodpecker painting. And so this was oil on canvas, and you know, which is a pretty difficult task for a six-year-old.
Yeah, I was going to say, you're six and painting in oil paints. This is already a bit of a challenge. So how did the painting turn out?
Well, if you looked at it now, you'd say that's pretty darn good for a six-year-old.
At the time, though?
Well, it was a long process getting there. I think I did the body first, and then it came time to paint the head. And so I got the red paint out, and I started painting inside the lines to make the basically round head.
Right.
And as I was trying to control the paintbrush, I found that I would go outside the line a little bit. And I kept doing the same thing over and over again.
And the head got bigger and bigger and bigger, right?
The head got bigger and bigger and bigger, yeah. And at a certain point, I remember sitting back and looking at the whole thing and realizing that the head was bigger than the body. At this point, I was, you know, again, about ready to cry at six. So I went to find the teacher to see if she could solve this problem. And when I brought her back to the table, my friends on either side of me had taken some yellow paint and put two big eyes, a dot nose, and a big smiley face on it. And, you know, I burst into tears, and the teacher was able to rescue the painting somewhat.
Did you present it to your grandmother then?
Yes. Yeah, and she was thrilled with it. And despite where it ended up, I know that she was thrilled with it.
What do you mean, where it ended up?
Well, she hung it in the outhouse.
Did that hurt your feelings?
No, not in the slightest. You know, I mean, I look back at it now and think think otherwise, but at the time I was proud to have it up there. My painting hung in there from 1956 to 1977.
What happened in 77?
Well, my grandmother passed away. I believe what happened was there must have been an estate sale, and the woodpecker painting must have been part of the estate sale, and a woman who lived in a nearby town bought it. Now, I can only imagine she must have hung it in her living room, I'm sure.
Or maybe she just got it with all the other art. You know, that's a possibility, too.
Maybe she had a little museum there. But at any rate, it surfaced again for me last year.
Wait a minute. That's 30 years later.
Yeah.
How did you find it?
Well, it came to me. You know, I tune pianos, and the first thing I do when I get home is I check the answering machine. And the first message on the machine was from a man I didn't know, and he basically said, I'm not sure if I found the right Tom Sivak, but I have your woodpecker painting.
Now, you're in Illinois at this point. Where's the call come from?
Iowa.
Okay.
And so I called him right back. Sure enough, he had it, you know, and on the back of the painting, it says Tommy Sivak, 6 years old, and evidently he must have Googled me.
What did you think when you heard the message the first time?
Well, I mean, I wanted it back, you know, I mean, this was incredible.
And you knew exactly what he was talking about.
Well, it had to be my painting, and besides, you know, being an artifact from my youth, this was a pretty stressful day in my life, you know, this item caused me some distress, you know.
That's what gets me, you know, I probably... you know, drew 100 pictures at around that age, and I wouldn't be able to identify a single one of them. But the one that gets kept and eventually traced back to you is the one that's got all this angst attached to it.
I know, isn't it amazing?
I'm talking with Tom Sivak about the long, strange journey of his childhood rendering of a woodpecker. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Tom was still a bit unsure, even after this man had called from Iowa with word of the woodpecker oil painting.
And so, you know, I thought he probably wanted some money. And the truth is, I'd be happy to pay him for it. I mean, I don't know him. Why should he do me a favor?
So you called him?
I called him, and you know, sure enough, that was the painting. And he said he'd mail it to me. And I says, well, can I write you a check? And he says, no, I don't need anything. I said, well, at least let me pay for the postage. He says, no, let me do this for you. And so it arrived a few days later.
And what kind of condition was the painting in?
Well, it looks just the way it did, you know, last time I saw it. It's in good shape.
It's been 30 years since you even saw the outhouse that it was in, right?
Right.
And where is it now?
Well, it hangs in my studio. I have a room that I teach piano in. And
do you tell the story often?
Well, when I got it, you know, it was such a bizarre story that, yeah, I would show the kids the painting.
Is there a moral to this story or a lesson?
Well, I don't know if there's a moral, but it certainly represents my best attempt, and it, you know, it looks passable, especially for a six-year-old. You got to go, that's not bad.
Yeah, but think about this. You got the art teacher who makes sure that the painting does not disappear. You have the grandmother who makes sure that the painting doesn't disappear. Then you have this person you've never met in Iowa City who does the same thing and makes sure the paint. It's meant to be hanging close to you. I don't know who meant that to happen. But
you're right. That is bizarre, but it has found its way back to me, and, you know, I'm happy to have it.
So I'm going to get you to make a digital image of that and send it to us so our listeners can see it on our website.
Well, that would be great.
And then it'll be properly shared. It won't be just abandoned in an outhouse. We can give this painting its moment in the
Well, if anybody takes the time to do that, I will give you a close-up of the head. And if you look in the background, now the sky is kind of yellowish, but if you look in the background, you can see this red halo all around the head. And you can see exactly how big that head was at one point.
I'll look for that. Tom, thanks so much for your story.
Well, thank you.
My guest was Tom Sivak. And we have those images of the woodpecker and the inscription on the back. It's all at our website. You can find us at thestory.org. And you might be surprised to know just how many of the stories you hear here are stories that come directly from you. Every day, people are logging on to thestory.org and leaving us suggestions of great stories or people who have good stories. Sometimes stuff that's smack in the news, and sometimes things that are a little more private, a little more personal. Anyway, we have this category that we call Your Story. And these are the stories that tell of one moment in your life when something happened that somehow made a difference. Might be a brief encounter with a complete stranger. Maybe the central moment of an intense family matter. We've gone after everything from those stories of travel misadventures to stuff that happens in your own backyard. The only rule is this: it has to matter to you. It has to be something that you'd put on the personal highlight reel of your life. So think about it. If you have something you'd like to share, give me a call or leave me a note on our website. Our telephone number is 1-888-966-9862. All you have to do is leave us a few sentences. We'll get back to you. Or you can write out a small part of it or the whole part of it on our website at thestory.org. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.